This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. Members of the Naples-based rock band Cyborg Dangerfield celebrate the release of their first full-length album with a show tonight at South Street City Oven and Grill. Later this hour, we'll hear recorded selections of Cyborg Dangerfield's original music and talk with members of the band. But first, just in time for Halloween, horror author and Florida history and folklore researcher Mark Muncy has published a new book detailing some of Florida's strangest tales of murder, mystery, monsters, and more, titled Freaky Florida. I recently sat down with Muncy in the WGCU studios for a closer look at some stories in the book, several of which originate from right here in Southwest Florida. Let's hear that conversation now. Joining me now in studio is horror and science fiction author and Florida history and folklore researcher Mark Muncy. Muncy is the author of the newly published book Freaky Florida, along with illustrator Carrie Schultz, who is Muncy's fiance. The book includes Florida-based stories of horror, tragedy, monsters, the supernatural, the macabre, and sometimes just downright strange occurrences that have solidified often into obscure myths or popular legends, but also the fascinating history behind those stories. Freaky Florida is the result of thousands of miles of travel and research throughout the state, and actually marks the second volume of such stories from Muncy and Schultz following the 2017 publication of their book Eerie Florida, Chilling Tales from the Panhandle to the Keys. Previously, Muncy authored the book 31 Tales of Hellview Cemetery with fellow author Elizabeth Abbott. That was re-released a year later with its fictional elements redacted as Tales of Terror of Tampa Bay. Muncy has also written numerous other works of short fiction and essays under various pseudonyms, as one description reads, quote, to keep his name clear. For two decades, Muncy has operated a haunted house in St. Petersburg called Hellview Cemetery, which was named after a lost Tampa Bay cemetery called Hillview. The attractions in that haunted house were based on the folklore legends Muncy has collected throughout Florida. Mark Muncy, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, John.
And our conversation was previously recorded ahead of this broadcast, so we won't be taking calls, but listeners can still connect with the show on Facebook. We're at WGCU Public Media, or on Twitter. We're at WGCU. Use the hashtag GCL. And Mark, before we delve into the book, I was hoping you could tell us more about yourself and the work you've done that's led up to this most recent publication. First of all, I want to go back to 1996 when you first opened the Hellview Cemetery Haunted House. How did that all come about?
I had been fascinated with, you know, Halloween and the like for, you know, years, my whole life basically. And I was a new father at that point. I had actually worked at Halloween Horror Nights and a bunch of the other local attractions over the years. And I was a new father at that point and was like, oh, you know, I can't afford to take my daughter out to Horror Nights because that's expensive.
Right.
And a long trip to Orlando. So we decided to make our own little display, a few friends of mine. And we built a thing. We were going to build a haunted cemetery. And we started digging a grave. And that's when we found shells and bones. And we were like, wait a minute, you know, what have we found? So we thought maybe it had been an ancient crime scene or something. So we called the police. Police came out. They sent an archaeologist from the St. Petersburg Junior College at that time. That's all grown up and is now St. Pete College.
Okay.
So I'll give you a time frame here. But then they came out and they said, oh, it's a shell midden. You live on a shell midden that's been plowed over. So then they were like, but we're just happy it's not one of the lost cemeteries. And that's where
– what?
And I was like, wait, what? Lost cemeteries? I've never heard of this. I know all these monsters and stuff. And so that's when I started becoming fascinated with local legends and local lore. We found out one of the lost pioneer cemeteries at Tampa Bay was called Hillview. And of course, the Tales from the Crypt fan in me said, oh, it's got to be Hellview. And so that was when we decided to base everything on local legends.
Well, and I've read descriptions that, you know, even early Native Americans in Southwest Florida tended to avoid this area.
Yeah. Yeah. That's part of the story was that the middens and stuff were not just garbage dumps. They were warnings. Stay away from this area. And that's, of course, to us, the legends, that is immediately, oh, man, this is what we've got to put into the haunted house. And so we, you know, we made sentinels and stuff like that, you know, and that and that's where the first book came from, was just the stories we put up on the website to draw people in, to, you know, give them something. Most people when they're walking through don't care, but then there's the little percent that goes, oh, that's that, and that's, you know, that's mini lights and things like that. And that's when we're like, okay, yeah, that's the people we want to hit.
So. And to be clear, the haunted house was on the property that you lived on.
Yeah, it was in my backyard. Wow. And then eventually the front yard. And it grew and grew for many years. And we had a few thousand people tromp through every holiday season. But, you know, it got a little too big. So the city of St. Pete's like, you know, gotta tone it down or shut it down. And so for the last few years, it's been dark. We're looking for a new location. But in the meantime, that gave me some time to write some books.
All right. So hopefully this will be coming back at some point.
We always say Hellview will rise.
All right. So I also know some paranormal researchers, actually several over the years, have come and checked out the site. Has that been – have you had anything to do with that?
Well, we had one group come through the haunted house one time, just going through the haunted house, and their medium – came up to us and said, hey, do you realize that you've tapped into something here? There's a fear creature, fear monger in your backyard that's enjoying this and feeding on this. And I'm like, well, cool. Do we have to pay him to stay, or is it just, you know, is he help? Yeah, you know, he's a volunteer. So that was kind of cool. We've had some unusual experiences, but nothing, concrete or anything. But we've had other paranormal groups come and investigate the place. But since we've stopped doing the haunted house, you know, it's been quiet. So.
All right. Maybe that's a good thing.
Like sleeping it off.
Yes. I get the impression operating this was largely a labor of love.
Oh, yeah. Always. Yeah. It was all volunteers who love the haunts and everything. We gave every dime to charity that we collected. For years, we didn't even take donations. And then when we realized people were just trying to hand us money, we're like, let's find a good cause or two. And
right.
So it's Child's Play, and then a local organization up in St. Pete called The Kind Mouse stepped in that feeds transitional families. It was always a lot of fun.
And it sounds like the books that you've authored, you know, about the macabre and the bizarre aspects of Florida history maybe didn't initially spring from the haunted house, but all of those things came from this innate interest you seem to have in this aspect of history.
Yeah. I mean, it's it was that growing up in that, late 70s, early 80s, when the boom of science fiction, fantasy and all that, and horror, and, lived the video generation, VHSs and all that. So it was everything I could get my hands on. And then, of course, books, was nonstop. So that all fed everything. And then it was a matter of realizing how much history was involved with everything around it, and then I became a history buff on top of it.
Yeah. Tell me about your approach to research when you're, whether it was this book or it kind of seems like it's all happening at the same time, and then the stories come out when it seems to make sense for them to do so. Because I can't imagine you can approach this the way like a traditional academic scholar would, although there's an important aspect of that to it. Just a lot of travel. It seems like you've really just got to go to these places and see for yourself.
Well, and that's it. You'll hear, you can Google up Ghosts of St. Pete, and you'll get the local ghost tour. You'll get some legends. Usually there's a few websites that love just collecting the local stories, and some of them are totally embellished and stuff like that. Like one recent we just did, we're researching a third book, and this one was we went there looking for a ghost, and it was Krabby Bill's in Clearwater Beach, the original Krabby Bill's, supposed to have this ghost in the bathroom and all these crazy stories. We get there and everybody's like, oh, it was made up for a commercial back in the 70s and all this stuff. So we're like, oh my God, well, how's the story grown up so much from this? And then somebody else told us, oh, wait, the Krabby Bill's in St. Pete Beach actually has a ghost, and that's the one they don't talk about. So when we went there and asked some of the locals there, some of them were like, yeah, I don't stay here after dark. I don't do this. So suddenly we had a whole different story. And that's – so the research, you have to find your historical references and all that. But then when you actually go there, it may wind up being a wild goose chase and you're going off on something else.
As far as what might appear in the third book, are some of these stories you've maybe had in your back pocket for a while now? But – oh, go ahead.
No, it was definitely – the first two books we – if they're light on ghost stories, I will say that. Just for the main premise is that I kept thinking there are so many ghost stories that we would definitely have one volume of nothing but ghost stories. And that's the one we're working on now.
So. Excellent. I can't wait. I say as I'm – this one just came out last month, so let's give it time. Well, let's go ahead and delve into some of the stories in Freaky Florida. I wanted to start with one that took you to Green Swamp Wilderness Preserve in the Lakeland area. And you mentioned that this place got the nickname Green Hell. Tell us about this.
Okay. Well, the Green Swamp, well, when you look at a Florida map, especially if you look at like one of those that shows the light from above you, especially like some of the NASA photos of Florida, you see all the lights on the beaches, you know, because that's where civilization is. Then a little further in, you see all the big cities where everybody who's feeding all the beaches are. And then you go a little further in and it's a little less, a little more rural, a little darker. And then there's these big black spots where there's nothing in the center of Florida because that's mostly swampland and forest. And that's the Ocala National Forest and the Green Swamp. Now, the Green Swamp is a lot of the headwaters of the aquifer of Florida is all under the Green Swamp. They call it the Green Swamp Water Management District now. It's mostly federally controlled. And they you know, but they allow hunters, they allow hikers, they allow all kinds of stuff out there. But this area, the reason it's called Emerald Hell is if you spend any amount of time out there and you're not prepared, it's just swamp. It's bugs. It's, you know, it's oppressive heat and, you know, and of course our wonderful weather, you know, with our crazy storms and everything just blowing through. And with no warning, it can drive a person crazy. And that's what it's done. There have been people who get lost out there for a few hours and just, you know, come, you know, seasoned woodsmen, and they come back freaking out, covered in mosquito bites and, you know, and gibbering. But of course, that's also the home of numerous legends, and including our wonderful Florida skunk ape and our relative of Sasquatch, because Florida loves to name things.
Yes. Well, we got to make it our own.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It can't just be a skunk. It can't just be a Sasquatch. He smells bad. Let's call him the skunk ape.
Yes.
That'll stick. And then, you know, we went there looking for a famous – there was a case where there was a murder in the middle of the – at a homestead out there back when it was still – you know, people were homesteading it, trying to make a living out of the land out there before they realized, you know, this place is terrible. Let's get out of it.
Yeah.
But a family got murdered there, the Stewart homestead. It's a marker there. There's a historical marker there. And they were so brutally murdered, people assumed it had to be some sort of monster or some sort of animal kill them. So originally they went looking for, you know, the monster, the beast, or, you know, the skunk ape. And sure enough, it turned out to be, you know, a relative, you know, who knew they had money and, you know, did it brutally. But, you know, and he eventually was brought to justice. But, you know, so that was a cool story we went looking for. And then we found others while we were there. So.
Yeah, and you include a photo in the book of the Stewart homestead, which still stands
still
after
there.
100 years.
And after how many hurricanes and stuff have blown through there, and it's still there. That's how solid it was built. I mean, it's barely there. It's more of a frame, but still there. We actually credit that photo to David Sidoti of the Independent Sasquatch Research Team. He and his crew went out because we went to go out there that day to get our photo, and the trees had been blown down all around. We couldn't actually get there. And then he and his team went a week later and got it for us. So, because I wanted to make sure it was still there after Irma.
Right, right. Yeah. And I got to say, like, I mean, it's a black and white photo, which I think sort of maybe adds something to it, but I don't think that's where it gets the entirely. That's not where the eerie effect comes.
No,
in that
we were
photo.
There the year before, and that is just a creepy place. The graves are right there. And it's just, you know, that whole area, you'll walk through those woods, and we stumbled on an old 1940 truck that was just rusting, covered in vines and being reclaimed by nature.
Wow.
And it was just in the middle of nowhere. No, not marked on any map, not marked on any of the Trailblazer stuff. And we were just like, well, let's put this down. You know, it's just some other weird piece in the Green Swamp.
Yeah. And then, of course, many, many years later in 1975, the skunk ape is brought up again as a possible suspect.
Right. On the outskirts of one of the outskirts of the Green Swamp near Lakeland, there's a place called Devil's. It's another devil name. There's a lot of those in Florida, so they blur in my head, I'm afraid. But there's a
– Devil's Creek Swamp.
Devil's Creek Swamp. Devil's Creek Swamp. Thank you very much for that. Thanks for pulling up my book. there's these series of robberies around there, unusual things like, you know, clothes disappearing, cereal disappearing from the cabinets. They, you know, what the heck's this?
Yeah.
And so the police quickly realize they've got – somebody, you know, doing this. It's not a skunk ape. Everybody was convinced it was a skunk ape because the few people had seen him said they saw this, you know, crazy hairy thing with a big stick. And but then when they got out there, they realized they wind up catching him. They lure him into a trap, and it's this little is a Chinese sailor from Tampa who had gotten into a fight on a tanker and went to the hospital And then he was convinced he was going to go to jail or something worse. So he fled the hospital and wound up somehow in the Green Swamp, wound up living there for 6 months, maybe a year. You know, and like I said, there are people who go out there fully equipped and are freaking out. So this guy's living out there. Wow. And he's fashioned a stick, a big pike with a railroad spike from one of the abandoned railroad tracks out there. And he uses that to catch armadillos and cook them. He thinks they're lost pigs is what he called them. And then, you know, he's eating the corn from all the trappers and, you know, and hunters that are leaving traps for deer. And he's cooking all that and surviving out there. When they finally catch him and they bring him back, they only learn all this stuff because they finally get a translator to talk to the guy. And he was convinced that they were going to kill him. He's like, please, you know, let me kill myself. Don't – whatever you're going to do to me, please let me meet my ancestors. And sure enough, he winds up killing himself with a belt. It was just a poor, strange man in a lost world.
Yeah. Very strange. You also include a chapter about the Rosewood Massacre near Cedar Key in early 1923. Really just an incredibly tragic piece of Florida history and largely forgotten until the 1980s. Maybe for those who maybe haven't heard this story, can you maybe just tell us a little bit about the background there?
Yeah. Rosewood is one of the darkest spots in Florida history. And it was actually one – just like when we researched for our first book, we researched the Dozier School for Boys, which
yeah.
is – oh my gosh, terrible. That's in Erie, Florida. But this is just as bad, if not worse. This was a and again, it was one of those – we went looking for the ghosts because everybody talked about the ghosts of the area. But the true history, the dark history behind it is so much worse. And so it was one of those where we just we want – the story has to come out. The town of Rosewood was mostly made up at this point in the early 1900s was mostly former families of freed slaves. They had founded this whole community, became basically an African-American community. The rest of the population kind of moved over to Cedar Key, which of course just got hit by a storm. So hopefully everybody's okay up there now.
Yeah.
But Rosewood was the neighbor city a few miles away. Well, one young lady got beat up by her boyfriend and didn't want her husband to know. So she made up a story that she was beat up by an African-American gentleman. This is in the 60s. And so they realized it has to be Rosewood, people from Rosewood. So – and they're hiding this guy. And there was a story about this guy who had just gotten out of jail and all this. Well, at the same time in Tallahassee, the KKK are having a massive rally. And so the story from Cedar Key gets over to those guys and they all immediately start descending on the town of Rosewood. And what starts as, he said, she said, basically devolves into a full-on racial, attack. And they start lynching guys and it's just terrible. It's a dark history. It started coming out when a reporter in the 80s was researching it, had heard names of it and stuff, but there was this culture of silence around it. Nobody talked about it. The survivors didn't want to talk about it because they were afraid somebody would come after them. They were going to hunt them down.
So they weren't believed at the time.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And it had kind of hit the papers for a few days, but then Florida just kind of swept it under the rug because, we don't want to stop our burgeoning tourist industry. Mm. And so it was a terrible, terrible time. And like I said, that culture is just weird. And now the town of Rosewood is barely there. There's a few buildings, some houses, but no remnants of what was there. Now finally there's a marker, a historical
marker.
That's
what I was going to ask you because I think you mentioned a historical marker a bit further away.
Yeah. They moved it a little further down the road just to kind of show where it was and all this. And it's got a little bit of the story. There was a famous movie made about it, but they kind of – they changed the story to make it Hollywood. And so definitely there's a few great books on Rosewood. I try to touch on a lot of it in our book. But definitely if you want to learn more about that, there are plenty of great stories of Rosewood. And it's a dark spot we do need to heal from still.
Yeah. Well, in the interest of focusing on tales in the book with kind of a Southwest Florida connection, since that's where we're located right now, you write about the lost pyramids of Corkscrew March, which, if they existed, wouldn't really have been very far from where we are right now.
No.
And personally, I was really surprised, having lived in Southwest Florida for as long as I have and had never having had heard of this story.
This was one of those ones occasionally, doing the plus side for researching this stuff, having the first book come out and we hit big. We'd done a couple Coast to Coast AM, which is a big overnight paranormal show. It's a big nationally syndicated show. And I started getting emails and a lot of people saying, you need to investigate this, you need to investigate that, you need to, you know, go look for this. And some of them were really out there. And so most of them went into the, okay, I'll look into this when I have time file. But then there was one that stood out, and he was talking about the pyramids. And I remembered reading an article where some people had gone looking for that years before. So I'm like, I've got some correlation here. So I started looking into it, and then I was like, okay. And then we got the map that this guy sent us, and it was because I started corresponding with the gentleman. And it was like, okay, this is doable. Here I am, late 40s and epilepsy, and we travel a lot for this, but it's not exactly like we're Indiana Jones going out into the wilderness. Some, but not as much as we probably should. But this one we definitely did. We suited up. We went out to the Corkscrew Marsh, which is not too far from here, like you said, down here, Fort Myers, Punta Gorda area. And we travel. There's actual recreation trail, Corkscrew Marsh. And we went out there, and it is literally the middle of nowhere, Florida. It is. You're wandering, and supposedly there's these pyramids there from an ancient civilization. And this was actually one of the things De Soto was looking for when he came to Florida, or possibly even Ponce de Leon, the wow. Legends of El Dorado. Yeah, they had found the pyramids down in South America, and there got to be some up here. What they didn't realize is the people here didn't have stone. You know?
Right.
So,
yeah.
So if there were these pyramids, maybe they weren't stone. And I think that might be part of the legend that they grew these pyramids. You know, there's the Crystal River Mounds. There's a bunch of mound complexes around. And Corkscrew Marsh probably had one at some point because there's remnants. There's lots of shell mounds out there. They're small. But I think if somebody saw them and, you know, reported these giant, possibly giant mounds that, it had to be, you know, this ancient civilization that was, you know, advanced and all this. And I think it's just a little bit of racism there, not taking into effect that these people could do stuff like that, you know,
right.
without advancements or anything. But anyway, we got out there. We did not find the pyramid that had snakes in the bottom like the guy had said. And supposedly the mounds matched up to the pyramids of Giza and all that, the plateau there, and because of their alignment had raised Florida up from the ocean. And so, you know, it's a lot of odd stuff, but it was still a cool place to visit. And, and definitely we love nature trails. You never know what you're going to find. And we found, you know, panther tracks. So that was always cool.
All right. Sounds like that's the kind of story that materializes the same way I think a lot of folklore does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people speculating, and then speculation becomes a detail the next time it's told. And
yeah, a little bit of telephone.
Yes, absolutely. And then also keeping the Southwest Florida twist here, you write about one of my favorite local history stories, Cyrus Teed and the Koreshian Unity.
Oh, yes.
And I've been fortunate enough in the past to actually get my hands on an early edition of Cyrus Teed's book, Cellular Cosmology.
Oh, wow.
If you've ever tried to read it, just don't. It reads like stereo instructions. This one's, I guess, less of a secret, maybe to folks here in Southwest Florida because it is a state historic site now. But what was it that interested you about this tale?
Well, again, a lot of people, a lot of these stories, I thought everybody knew.
Mm.
And then when we would start talking about them at speaking engagements and appearances, people would go, what's that place? I've never heard of that place. And I'm like, how do you not know about this? And so that's what you realize. Okay, it's very insular, you know, especially like I said, Cyrus Teed, right here, Fort Myers, a lot of people know about it. But even Tampa Bay, less than 2 hours away,
Nobody's
ever heard of it.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, you don't know the Bathtub Messiah? And
they're
like, no. I'm like, oh my gosh, we got to talk about this. So, that's the great thing. There's the Cyrus Teed, who became Koresh. He was one of the first to change his name to that. Had an incident. He was big in electric current and shocked himself and saw God. And God told him to come to Florida and build a center of the we're actually a hollow earth. We are above a space as a big ball of gas, and we're on the inside of a shell. And build the new Jerusalem. Build this giant place in Estero, Florida. So they bought land. They started, as you guys know, and they built this beautiful land for themselves. They built buildings. They're very self-sufficient. They had their own power plant long before there were power plants.
Their own
printing press. Yeah. They had their own, sawmill. They were doing all kinds of crazy advanced stuff. And they actually wound up getting like Tesla and Edison were interested in them and some of their philosophies. He was building all these crazy inventions that God was telling him how to build to prove that they were on the inside of the earth, and of course, never really came of much of anything. And of course, when he died, they were convinced he was coming back. And so they left him in the bathtub for several days, convinced he was going to rise on the third day. That didn't happen. And but then when the fungus started growing on him, they were like, see, life is coming back from him. And that's when the health department made him take him away and they buried him in the bathtub, which is famous. And then a hurricane came along later, destroyed the crypt where he was in and washed him out to sea. There's all these kinds of crazy
stories. So who knows? Maybe he did come back. We don't know.
We don't know. That's what they said. they eventually died out. The last one donated the land to the state. She was famously quoted as saying, I finally stopped believing that we were the center of an Earth when we landed on the moon. So now it's a beautiful state park. They're actually dropping the historic site name to it because they want to focus more on the land and how beautiful it is and how cultivated it is. There's still going to be the buildings there, including the famous globe that shows his vision of the cosmology. And this is just a great place. And again, nobody knew the story outside of this area, which has surprised me.
There is a local murder mystery associated with them too, with Gustav Domkohler's children. I don't know if you'd heard that story.
I've heard a little bit of that one. That was one we were starting to look into, and it was just one of those – let's focus on this for this book.
Sure. I actually went out with a group from the Florida Public Archaeology Network several years ago with ground-penetrating radar where they were actually looking for where their bodies might have been buried on the site.
Fascinating.
I don't think they found anything. I need to double-check with them. Tell us about the giant turtle of 1932 in Punta Gorda, because this is another one where I was like, how have I never heard of this?
There's one in each book that I'm sitting here going, I think I have the only – I've never seen this in print anywhere. And I'm like, well, I'll never be able to do it. Mm-hmm. The first one was our gnomes from Bach Tower in the first book. And I'm like, there's never going to be any corroboration on this because I had this interview with this little old lady from the 80s and early 90s. And I'm like, this will never be corroborated. And then I found a guy who corroborated it. And I'm like, oh, sweet. I can run it. This one was another one of those. I'm like, we'll never find anybody who knows anything about this story. It's a legend. And sure enough, somebody at the Charlotte Harbor Reserve had heard the story and was able to tell us about a thing later. And I'll tell the story real quick and then I'll get to how we corroborated it.
Okay.
But anyway, 1932, we had one of those wonderful things that just came through, a hurricane. And it was the Florida-Alabama hurricane came through and it went right up the coast. And last year during Irma, we noticed this phenomena where it sucked all the water out of Tampa Bay and people were walking on the base of Tampa Bay and picking up crabs and fish that because it just got caught because the water sucked out so fast. Well, this happened apparently right near here, Fort Myers, Punta Gorda area, sucked out the water. And this is the 30s, so everybody's still in the Depression. People still need money and they're going out there and they could feed their family for a month if they can catch some of this stuff. So this family runs out, a family of four, according to the legend, goes out there and they see way out a chest, like a pirate chest, like, oh my gosh, treasure. That who needs crabs and lobsters? We can go out and get this. So they run out there to go see what this chest is. And they're fighting with it for a while. Now, at this point, the water is starting to come back. But they want to get this chest open. They're like, this could save their family. And they finally just break it open. What's inside the chest? Cannonballs. Useless to them. Especially now water is coming in. Cool, fine, but not anything that's going to be valuable to anybody at that point. So they start trying to get back to land. They get caught up in a wave and get washed somewhere else. And this is where it gets foggy. The legend gets foggy. They are washed inland, but the waters are still rising. They're trying to find solid ground. They find a hill and they go over to this giant hill and they sit on this hill. And it's got a tree growing out of it. They're hanging onto the tree. The water's still rising. They're convinced they're going to drown. And suddenly it's loose, floating in the water and sailing along. And that's when they're riding the current. They're like, oh, gosh, we're going to get washed out to sea. We're back in the same boat. This must be an upside down boat that just stuff's grown on. And sure enough, as they're on that, they realize, no, this is something steering. It's going against the current. And the daughter looks down and sees a flipper. And then they see another flipper. And then they see a head. And they're like, oh my gosh, it's a turtle. We're on a giant turtle, enough for a family of four. So crazy story. Apparently saves them. There's not really an ending to that legend that I could find where they've lived or anything like that. So I'm like, there's never going to be a corroboration of this.
Yeah.
1966, many years later, a Navy diver was doing some work on the Charlotte Harbor Preserve. area, and that's where we got our corroboration. He's out there and he sees a giant sea turtle. He says 30 feet long, shellless, swimming near him. He is so scared by it that he files an official report, and they had a sketch artist draw it for the U.S. Navy. So we had an official document talking about a giant turtle in that same area. 30 years later, turtles, a giant turtle, who knows how long they're going to live.
Right.
Yeah. So immediately we're like, okay, we got it. And of course, my wonderful fiance and illustrator, Carrie Schultz, brought it to life and is one of our illustrations and definitely has become the standout star of the new book.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. It's yeah, I was fascinated. I'm like, how is this all in my backyard? And I just wasn't aware. You know, and I think every place has its own unique history and its own – develops its own folklore if it's been around long enough and established long enough. But do you think there's something characteristically unique about the kind of myths, legends, and folklore that come out of Florida? And I think by that I mean like it wasn't until I read books like A Land Remembered by Patrick Smith that I realized, wow, this place was a lot like the Wild West, a lot longer than the places I grew up in.
You know, yeah, exactly. Definitely more than the Midwest and up north and all that. I mean, this place, there's still places that are still kind of untamed. I mean, that's definitely, you know, as we've been driving around to some of these places, we go – you know, you go just a few hours outside of, you know, a major city and you're still untouched wilderness again. And again, Green Swamp, Ocala National Forest, and stuff that's been reclaimed. You know, so many ghost towns out there and so many railroads, you know, and settlements that came through as they were trying to get to Tampa, trying to get to Miami, Flagler and all the guys trying to get their trains through at all costs. Just they would build these roads and then they would just stop. And then suddenly the town just goes away a few years later.
Right.
So, yeah, that stuff's going on. But the legends here, like I said, our favorite thing is the names. The names, Florida is so great with names. We have a city on the Gulf. And it's a port, so we call it Gulfport. You know, there's a, we're not really creative. There's a monster in the St. John's River. It's the color of boiled shrimp. Let's call it Pinky. There's never, the Barden, the beast. No, he's the Barden booger. It's something about Florida and just our wonderful wackiness. Mm. I mean, that goes all the way down to the Keys. The Keys is the home to all that and all that. So, but just everything. It's just we have this pioneer spirit still to this day. And even though we're all tourists and all that, but it's just fun how some of these legends just spring up. And some of them are recent, some of them are ancient, and then some of them tie together. And that's where we find the most fun.
All right. Well, Mark Muncy's new book is Freaky Florida. He's also the author of Eerie Florida, Chilling Tales from the Panhandle to the Keys, also Tales of Terror of Tampa Bay, and 31 Tales of Hellview Cemetery. And of course, in the future, we'll be looking out for a third volume of The Strange and Freaky and Ghostly Florida. Mark Muncy, thanks so much for speaking with us today.
It was an honor. Thank you so much.
That was our previously recorded interview with Mark Muncy about his latest book with Carrie Schultz titled Freaky Florida. We're taking a quick break, but when we return, the Naples-based rock band Cyborg Dangerfield celebrates the release of their first full-length album. We'll hear music from the album as we talk with members of the band. That's just ahead. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.